Hello, cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 121 of Crosshairs Radio. On today's show, a little bit of a change. We're not going to talk about cyclocross, but we are going to talk about cycling. In the basement, I had the pleasure to speak with Daniel Devizet. He is an author and a journalist and has written several books. His latest is on Greg LeMond, and specifically, we're centering around his comeback to win the Tour after a hunting accident. But really, the whole story and the whole story of road cycling from that era to the present. It's an amazing book. It's something that I think you should all check out, called The Comeback. You can get it wherever you purchase books, electronically or even in hardback from your favorite local bookstore. But yeah, we're going to get into that conversation in just 1 minute. But before we do, I want to talk to you quickly about the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network. That is the place that hosts Crosshairs Radio, also the Slow Ride Podcast, Bike Shop CX, Consummate Athlete, the Meyerson Line. I mean, Adam just had this great interview with the bass player from Public Image Limited, who also races cyclocross up in New England. Just really cool stuff, and stuff you can only get at the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network, which we would love for you to become a member of. Go to wideanglepodium.com, sign up, $5 a month, $10 a month, on up, one-time donation. We want everybody to be part of this community. You get bonus coverage from being a member. You also get some cool swag. So please go there, sign up, help us support this network and keep it on the air. Also, while you're there, you can click on the, that was my dog in the background, you can click on the Grimper Brothers coffee link. We have a partnership with Grimper Brothers. They have amazing coffee. They have the full Schleck blend. That's what the link on the right side of the wideanglepodium.com page will take you to. Buy some coffee. Support those who support the sport. They've been a great sponsor, great partner for us, and we want is for you to have the best coffee, and that's the way to do it. Finally, we are talking about road cycling in this episode, but it is cyclocross season. Been covering a lot of the races so far on the UCI schedule in the U.S. Please go to my YouTube channel. Go to crosshairstelevision.com. That'll take you to the playlist for all the Crosshairs Television episodes, recaps of the Go Cross so far, and also Rochester Cyclocross. Heading out to Reno and Trek and Jingle, so tons more content up there. Subscribe to the CX Airs YouTube channel. That is, would be a huge help to me. Okay, I think that covers it all. If you've got any questions, hit me up at feedback@cxairs.com. Follow on Instagram and Twitter at CX Airs. Follow Dan at Daniel Devizet on Twitter. We're talking road racing. We're talking Greg LeMond. And we're doing that right now. Assuming that I'm actually going to record. Okay. You told me like 2 seconds ago, so I'm going to try to get it right again. Devizet, Dan Devizet.
Yes, sir.
Awesome.
Thank you for hosting me.
Absolutely. Thanks for doing this. I have actually a question for you to start out, since I run this cyclocross podcast mainly. We get off topic every once in a while, and this is a book about road cycling. How'd you find me?
Oh, good question. We were chatting before we went on air, and I was telling you that with this book, I've been on probably more podcasts than radio broadcasts. And one of the issues is, you know, try and find a cycling show on a radio station. There aren't. I mean, there are none, or there are a few, and I haven't been able to find very many. So at one point, after I'd been approached by a few podcasters, I actually did a couple of Google searches and found like blog posts that said, here are like 5 really good cycling podcasts. And no doubt yours was on one of those couple of lists. And so I think I emailed you.
Yeah.
And I think you emailed me back. We didn't even realize we were in the same city.
Right.
At first.
Yeah, no, this worked out great. It's I do a lot of these via Skype, and it's always when I can get somebody here, it's always great to have a in-person conversation. And we're here because you wrote a book about Greg LeMond, and you know, going through his whole story. But I can tell you just before we get into it that it took me about 3 days to read. I loved it and read it on my way up to Mount St. Anne for Mountain Bike World Cup. How you started the book in the prologue, you know, very cinematic, just starting with the famous time trial at the end of the tour. That was actually the first race, cycling race that I watched.
Really?
That I, yeah.
The 89 tour, the big one.
So I was 17 years old, didn't really know much about cycling. It wasn't, you know, I didn't come from a family that was into it. Rode bikes, lived in Richmond, Virginia at the time, but.
Oh, big, but never, cycling city.
Yeah, it is now. Like Worlds down there was amazing. But yeah, so that sort of drew me in, and then I loved it. You know, you went into it, you got right up to the exciting part, and then boom, right into the story. It was perfect. It was very cinematic start to your book.
It was an amuse.
Yeah. But you are not a sports writer.
No, sir.
Not a cycling journalist.
No.
So why write a book about Greg LeMond?
Well, it's a great question. You get more to the question of what makes a good book. And I was finding myself kind of burrowing into this kind of biography space. My last book was a dual biography of the actors Andy Griffith and Don Knotts. And half of you are going to throw down your headphones hearing that. What on earth am I listening to this for? A guy who writes about Mayberry.
I'm the exact opposite. I'm looking that up next, you know, for my next trip.
I'm trying to follow the old credo from my journalism career, which is kind of write what you know. And having done that book, and I was related to Don Knotts, which is a whole other story you won't have time to get me to tell you. But I just was looking for a really great story, just as somebody who's thinking of doing a movie, because I think the best books tend to get made into movies. I was just looking for an amazing story. And I wish I could say I was biking. I was probably walking around Garrett Park, my town, one day. And it just occurred to me, like, holy, you know, this Greg LeMond thing would make an amazing book. Because my literary agent has been trying to drill into my thick Belgian-American skull that you've got to have a character in a book, in a narrative nonfiction book, who overcomes, like, you know, conflict, like, you know, high school English class style conflict. And I could not think of another person who'd overcome as many different amazingly huge HC conflicts.
Well, that's the thing. You know, you look at the story and you touch on all the points. You know, it's called The Comeback. It's you know, I guess the crux of it is him with his accident with getting shot by his brother-in-law and then coming back and winning the tour, not to give anything away. but there's so many stories. And yeah, I mean, you know, I think they did the 30 by 30 on Le Mans.
There's that one too.
Yeah. But I'm saying that's a whole nother book right there. You do a great job covering that, but that's a whole nother story within there. So yeah, you definitely.
You know, people among your listeners, and they're going to be knowledgeable. You know, if you're listening to this podcast, you know cycling probably. You might think you know what these four or five big conflicts are, but you don't know them as well as you think you do. I mean, just start with him being a survivor of sexual abuse when he was an adolescent and just living through that and getting past it and doing anything, not curling up into a ball after going through that is a huge, huge accomplishment for Greg. And I assert in the book, and I'm not the first person to dream this up, but that to some extent, I think that's what you guys who ride bikes a lot all have some kind of demon, something that's driving you, or else he wouldn't take the punishment, right? And that was like, maybe that was his demon, you know?
I have this written down, and it was actually one of the main things I wanted to sort of pick your brain on, because that we see that going back to Mozart, going back to Van Gogh, going to Richard Pryor. You know, it seems like people who do great things, I know that this is a theory that's out there, have to have something in them that's broken.
Like a trauma or something in the past.
Do you think, so, because I've talked to sports psychologists, and there's Kristen Kimes, a big one. She has a lot of clients who race cyclocross, and her whole thing is kind of the opposite. She says you get one good race based on anger or that kind of, you know, that kind of trauma. But other than that, a more positive outlook and more coming from a happy place in the long run is going to do better. So I always like this different because, yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. I always saw it like that. I mean, some of the greatest heroes all have this struggle that's going on. And take that away, do you think LeMond still just isn't Greg LeMond that we know?
You know, I the question you have to ask with any American who becomes a great cyclist is how did they discover it at all? Because there's these flukes. You know, there's 300 million Americans, and a great many of us might have the potential to be great cyclists, but few of us will ever do it because it's this niche thing, you know, racing a bicycle. So the fact that Greg found the sport at all is maybe even the bigger miracle. It was because he was doing the hot dog skiing, and the ski camp people said you should cross train. I don't know if they called it that, on bicycles. So Greg and his dad started riding their bicycles pretty seriously. And so, lo and behold, it turns out both LeMond's father and son had these freakishly great hearts, you know, and the ability to process oxygen for energy. But there's this secondary thing which Hinault, Lance, the greats, Merckx, had, which is this, I guess, killer instinct or just take no prisoners approach. I mean, that's stupid hackneyed language. You know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about, right? And a lot of people say Greg didn't really have that. So how did he win, you know, three tours? How did he do all this stuff? So this thing about that cycling made him feel pure, it made him feel good. It was something wonderful and innocent and pure in his life that he could feel, that he could embrace coming out of the worst thing you could possibly go through, was probably what led him to it. And the natural drugs released by your body when you ride 50 or 100 miles on a bicycle, I think he got high on those natural drugs, and it just brought him happiness and joy and enthusiasm. And yeah, I mean, I think to some extent those demons were the thing that propelled him into race after race after race, and just trying to improve himself, trying to go in there and win and just succeed in this thing that he felt good and pure and joyous about. Maybe without that trauma in early life, he would have had the ability, this amazing once in a generation ability, but would he have had the drive? I don't know. And there are people out there who say he didn't have quite enough drive, and maybe that is why, you know, he didn't win more tours.
Well, you know, and you do the accent for that, and I think that's an interesting point in that. Somehow, Greg, I think, and you talk about like his outlook on life, the way he treats with people. Everybody loved him. He's a nice guy. He's approachable, and that's really not the archetype that we see in cycling. Mm-hmm. It's usually the loner, usually the guy who's, you know, just doing his own thing, or is even, you know, Fignon in this book is such a great foil because he's the complete opposite. He has a huge temper. He's not nice to people, and he just wants to get stuff done. And I think the genius of LeMond is that he still had all of that. He just was, you know, a nice guy, but it was underneath. There was still that going on. And I think once the whistle blew, once the neutral rollout stopped, he was just as nasty as anybody else.
I want to think that once he reached the high levels of the sport, once he'd gone to Europe and joined professional teams, that from that point on, I think his career was on autopilot, and he was so damned good that under the tutelage of a Guimard, you know, there was no question he was going to win races, even with or without that killer instinct. Certainly there, and you might know better than I, there are other cyclists who've won grand tours who are nice people. Andy Hampston, you know, for example, I spoke a lot to him over the last few years. You know, there's very nice people out there riding bicycles, but I think deep down they all have some kind of demon yeah. to go through the punishment they endure.
Yeah. I like the, you know, you touch on a lot the cultural differences that he's into. And, you know, since Greg did it and was kind of an American alone, you know, you talk about the one or two other Americans there, but they had sort of bought into the system. And now we see, you know, whole like Girona or wherever else, these whole American cycling villages, basically, or that it's a much different environment for them to race in Europe and train. And English is now the official language of the peloton, where it didn't used to be. So it's definitely easier to get into. But just what he had to deal with, you know, I think just touch on like the culture of it, that he was spending time with his wife and you didn't do that, and that people really thought he wasn't taking this seriously.
Even to the point that when he got shot, and this becomes this becomes the namesake comeback of the book, although I have to stress there's like huge massive obstacles he overcomes both before and after, one being the Slaying the Badger episode, where he's against all of France, literally every last French person is against him. But yes, he gets shot in a hunting accident, and rather than get like sympathy cards, and he gets some of those, he gets a lot of abuse from the purists over in Europe, saying, well, why on earth is the team captain not with his team? Why is he home, hunting? He had no business being there. So he takes flack for that. And it's his sort of bucking the conventions over and over again.
Yeah, there's one of the first Americans really to live in Belgium or Netherlands for cyclocross. It's Jonathan Page. And he was on Sunweb for a while, which is a big cyclocross team. And the story was he... just the same type of things. And after a race, he picked up his very young child, lifted him, and just got so much crap for that he should not be doing that. It's going to kill him for the next race and everything else. And just that, that cultural difference is just amazing. And yeah, you talk about like the all of France being against him, but he's also in a position where his own team's against him for half of this, and the whole, we look at Eno and how he is a very similar character to like Armstrong, even in just the mind games and just being the boss. And you're right. There's so many things in this.
I think when I'm at book talks, I tell the audience, forget about my writing and whether it's good or it's bad. Just consider the material, the underlying material, and the number of, again, like English class conflicts this poor man faces, the number of climbs he has to crest. We start with the sexual abuse, him being basically the first American to make any sort of dent on the European cycling sport, rising to the top of it, facing off against Hinault and all of France to win it. Coming back from this horrible shooting accident. And then the centerpiece of my book, of course, is the 89 Tour, which he had no business winning. I mean, he should have come in second in that race. And then in the latter, a lot of great sports figures after that peak, and in Greg's case, it'd be 89, 90, they go on and like start a sports bar or something. So there's nothing interesting after the top, But for me as a writer, I was blessed because so much happens to him after that. First of all, he fades, and so does Fignon. They both diminish, and they can't figure out why, because their metrics are coming back just as strong as ever. They're riding just as hard, but bizarrely, everybody else is riding a little harder in 91, 92. And then we find out, we're the sort of omniscient reader. We know what's going on, but I don't say that. Like, well, they don't know what's going on as it's happening. And oh, much later they figure out there's this new drug. And then the final two, three chapters, the last act of my book, is this nightmarish showdown between Lance and LeMond that occupies a dozen years and reduces Greg to an outcast, an exile from the cycling community. He should be the figurehead of it. The American cycling community. He should be the god, the icon, and yet instead he's virtually friendless and ridiculed and made fun of and fairly miserable for a lot of that time. So yet another enormous literary conflict that our hero has to overcome and doesn't overcome it until not that many years ago. When was that Oprah thing?
Yeah.
Not that long ago.
I know, it seems closer than it was, but I think it was a number of years, and now we finally have the, the settlement and the false claims. A suit with the Postal Service and Lance. And when's the last time you talked to Greg? Do you feel where do you think his character and he is as far as being rehabilitated back into the cycling community?
I think I think that from the Oprah appearance on, that certainly the media, the mainstream media, look at any article like in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, all of the mainstream press coverage of my book has treated this story as if this is the rightful recognition of the guy who always should have been the king of this sport. And the articles are fairly derisive toward Lance. Now, that's oversimplification to say that, because I've met a bunch of people, and I know that in the center of the cycling community, there's still a huge division between people who basically think Greg is God and are very, very, very critical of Lance, and then people who think, and many people have told me they think that to this day that Lance was the greatest cyclist of his generation.
Yeah, it's the level playing field argument.
The level playing field argument,
which I don't buy into at all. But
many people do. Yeah. Many very intelligent people do. I mean, I've sat just this close as to you, to dozens of really knowledgeable people who, and we've. I don't argue against that. What I say is, I state Greg's argument in my book, which is Greg believed, and he had his reasons, statistical reasons and such, that he didn't think Lance would have been at the level of a tour winner without unfair advantages.
Yeah.
Not just drugs, other stuff. But there's a very good counter argument, and somebody said to me, well, Lance did climb all those mountains. I mean, nobody did it for him. And everybody, all the other contenders, well, most of them anyway, were taking stuff too. So there's strong arguments on both sides.
Yeah, I guess my argument against that has always been that one of Lance's best strengths was being able to do the research to find the best out there to help him
of everything.
Cheat, right?
And oh, everything. Well, yeah, I mean, he would not use that word, right? He would say right. The best of everything, the best trainer, right? The best team, the best support system. And yeah, the best preparation, I'm making quote marks.
Right. Even to the point of, I think, you know, you hear where it's wanting it to be exclusive. So he's the only one with access to that type of preparation and his team, you know, and building that team. And that's kind of, you know, I sort of want your thoughts on this too. That was kind of, I think, his approach and his manager's approach to building a team kind of took a lot of joy that a lot of us had in following the tour, and that has continued with Sky. You know, I'm not saying the doping part, just saying how a team is built and how a Tour de France team is run, with, you know, the having nine guys basically in the mountains at the end and then just not being able to beat a team. It makes it less fun.
Well, wouldn't you say there's a host of inequities built into the Grand Tours, and always have been to some extent. I mean, back when you had national teams, you know, the French team would usually do pretty well. And in Greg's era, well, look at the 89 Tour. You had Greg on a very weak team against Laurent Fignon on a very strong one. And that simple fact made it much, all the longer the odds of Greg winning. He had to ride like a solo dude through a lot of that tour and faced derisive comments from the other riders, including Laurent, like, he's not riding like the Maillot Jaune. You know, well, he wasn't, because half his team had quit because, you know, they couldn't keep up or they were injured. So there are inherent unfairnesses.
Yeah, even to the point of like Delgado in there, right? Because his team was so bad and the team time trial isn't that the year
There a bunch of stuff, bad stuff happened to him, starting with him showing up late.
Oh, that's right.
By for a number the, of yes, minutes yes, to the first, the prologue.
Right. That's just,
so, yeah. But even that is complicating because he was minutes down, Fignon and Le Monde didn't mark him, and so he was able to make up that time, most of it in the end. But yeah, so to the point of Lance, there's always been kind of unfair advantages to one cyclist over another in the Tour. I think during the Lance era, though, maybe the whole thing got a little out of hand.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, and I think that, you know, you talk about the damaged person, and you know, I don't know, but I hear even with the, you know, another damaged person, Jan Ulrich, who's obviously going through some very difficult times now, according to the news reports we see. But hearing the stuff that like Lance even can't let that go now, Like, he's still playing mind games with Ulrich while he's going through this stuff. Like, this is like, you know, for a lot of these guys, it's like they never retire. It's,
old competitors, you know, maybe never die.
Yeah.
What I think is happening, and I should be talking more about Le Mans, but just to get back to Lance for a moment, I think if I were him, I would be rightfully PO'd that someone like an A-Rod can waltz back into his sport, into a really exalted place, a place of great prominence. And if you were Lance, you'd be seeing this not just with A-Rod, but with like Barry Bonds, people who were disgraced many years ago, are sort of newly sort of embraced and maybe even recognized in ways they hadn't been. I think right now in the baseball community, a lot of people think that Barry Bonds was indeed one of the all-time greats. And there's still huge arguments about it, but... And then A-Rod really, without any pause, progressed from a, shall we say, controversial baseball career into a really successful broadcast. And if you were Lance, you'd say, what the, why yeah. can't I do that?
Yeah.
And to some extent, maybe now he is. Well, happily, from the perspective of my book, my job was to tell that story from sure. Greg's perspective, which is a fairly critical perspective, and that's what I do. And, you know, you'll get Greg's kind of side of things in my book. But I also went to, I think, pretty great pains to explain, at least explain Lance's side of things from one episode to the next. And you know, make the argument that people who are his supporters would make for him mm-hmm. of why maybe after all he was a great champion, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely want to get back to the book just to sort of, on that same...
Well, this is contemporary stuff, so you yeah. got to talk about it.
On the same subject is what we see now, which I think there are, you know, cycling is small. There are a lot of knowledgeable people out there who can take over from this generation that continues to be a part of cycling. You know, I have a lot of friends who talk about who raced... at the top level, domestic level, who still are bitter about people like George Hincapie, Christian Vanderbilt, Gerold Steiner Ryder, Levi Leipheimer was a big one, who they feel like stole careers from them because they were clean, these guys weren't. And what I think sort of rubs me the wrong way and other people is that we still have these people around. We still have, and this isn't to say, and this is another thing, is that a lot of people who were caught doping are very nice people. You know, so that's like, take that off because that's always, he's a nice guy. Yeah, sure. But, you know, he's doing stuff that he shouldn't be doing. So somebody like Vandevelde doing broadcasts and that kind of stuff. I don't know. I'd like to see a cleaner sport, I guess. And to have like kids who want to get into it, have those people who are talking to them that are not, weren't in that system.
Well, one of the ideas that is in my book, and I think a Daily News columnist kind of coined it, is that you could think of Le Mans as like the Hank Aaron of cycling. Everyone thinks Hank Aaron was clean, you know. There aren't really anybody would question that. And he is now, I think, the god of the home run, you know, after Babe Ruth. And then in that analogy, Lance Armstrong becomes kind of the Barry Bonds. And does he deserve that level of credit? Because, again, I think people think Barry Bonds was maybe the standout player of his generation, even without the unfair advantages. I don't know if that's true of Lance or if it isn't. But it's a fair analogy that, so when Greg calls out Lance in 2001 to David Walsh, it's like Hank Aaron calling out Barry Bonds saying, I think Barry might be cheating.
Well, and then... You know, what you write about is Lance's response, and this is the thing, is that, and I think that, you know, ask you, that he truly believes this, that, well, but Greg's not clean. I mean, that's like his whole thing, is like, well, you were doping too. Yeah, obviously, you were doing this. And just that fact that he's like, there's no way, it's almost a tribute to what Le Mans did, that Armstrong believes there's no way he possibly could have had that success clean.
I tried to turn over every single stone to get to the bottom of who all over the course of five decades had ever accused Greg of anything and whether there was any legitimacy to the accusations. And I mean, I read every magazine, every article, interviewed everybody I could find. And near as I could figure, this idea that maybe Greg was doing something, the evidence for it is that very time trial that opens my book. And it's what a lawyer would call, I guess, circumstantial. And one of the retired cyclists from Greg's era made this case to me, and he had no evidence other than the simple fact of the time trial. Well, he couldn't have ridden it that fast without being on something. You know, is that a valid point? Well, I suppose it's a valid point, but there's no evidence. It's just that assertion.
And it's not like it was the fastest time trial ever.
And it's kind of like the mechanical doping arguments now that there are people out there who say that there were certain tour champions who rode up certain mountains in such a way that it looked unnatural.
Or
that's not evidence, really.
Or stretches of Paris-Roubaix.
It's circumstantial. It's circumstantial. Yeah. And then you see the images of the bike with the wheel turning seemingly of its own accord. But
those I don't. Those are like, I've seen bikes do, especially the lightweight bikes under so much tension now. But I mean, we dealt with it in cyclocross. I mean, that was the biggest one. Yeah. It was. Poor U23 girl. Who...
And my book goes all the way up, as you know, it goes all the way up to about a year or two ago, where Greg is trying to raise people's awareness to that issue of the possibility of concealed motors. There's a YouTube video, isn't there, of him demonstrating one?
Yeah. No, they're out there for sure. And I'll bet they've been raced in big races. I don't doubt that for a second. What concerns me is now it's another thing that... is used against one supporter group against another. Oh, well, that person definitely has a motor. And in cyclocross again. Now that's the easy accusation. Somebody has a good ride. They have a motor in their bike, you know, that kind of thing.
That's so it's sad.
Yeah. I wanted to, you talked about all of the research that you did and going back, and I'm assuming, you know, watching all of these broadcasts again. And this is sort of a weird aside, but just reading your book and a lot of the quotes that you had from the broadcast, what I guess I made me happy was to see why at one point we all liked Phil and Paul.
Oh, Phil and Paul were great in those years.
Yeah.
Just wonderful, wonderful team.
And they were so on it. And you have these quotes. I mean, even in the beginning, and it all makes sense. Unfortunately, that was kind of, I think, what they based the next 30 years on. And it's, you know, the same canned.
Became a tired shtick after a while.
It's a shtick. And I don't think that, and they no longer know the riders, and they no longer, you know, really are following the race. But it's like, you know, let's pull out Suitcase of Courage and go from there. But, you know, it was like, I think that's one of the things that if you are a cycling fan, or even, you know, don't know the story, or even you do, that is really endearing about that book.
Now, I don't know if Phil or Paul has read it. Paul's definitely aware of it because I corresponded with them and got two copies to him, one of which he was going to deliver to Phil. But I was a big fan of their shtick in the 80s.
I think we all were at that time.
I quoted liberally from their broadcasts because it's great commentary, and when Paul says, I think this is possibly the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. It's just, that's priceless. Yeah. It's like an all-time great quote from a broadcaster.
The other interesting thing, and this is just because it's kind of something that I struggle with right now, and I think what made this, why I remember that race and why I remember all of this time, we have it great now. We get to see it every second of every stage. Yeah. You know, if you want to sit there for 7 hours and watch a sprint stage, you can do it.
Be their guest.
Yeah, go for it. This was tape delay. It was like Wide World of Sports type broadcast.
Packaged.
Right? Yeah, packaged.
Yeah.
You know, 30 minutes, an hour.
That's
maybe.
That's what I remember, yeah.
Yeah.
When we come back, you know, Greg LeMond, can he win in Paris, you know?
I like having the ability to see everything. And I think this is where social media kind of gets in the way, because we all know results right away. I think about like Miracle on Ice, another tape delay event, but nobody knew because we weren't on Twitter. We weren't, you know, you didn't know what happened.
And there was no knowing unless you.
Yeah. The concept of spoiler didn't come up now. Yeah. I almost, do you, Would the sport be better if it was, you know, if we went back to that where it was more produced, or is seeing everything?
I don't know. I remember I'm older than a lot of people listening to this, and I remember the first years when I had to start telling my colleagues at like the Miami Herald, you know, you guys know that I'm the guy who watches the tour. Please don't tell me if it flashes across the screen
right.
that like Ulrich beat Lance or something. I don't want to hear it. I'm recording it on videotape. I want to watch it tonight, you know. And over the last bunch of years, the way you engage with the race is entirely different. The habit I formed probably in the late 90s, and I got back into it really because of Lance.
I
had tuned it out during the Indurain years. No offense, Indurain is a great guy, but I just wasn't as interested. Anyway, I got into the habit of kind of remembering which stages were the important ones and then taping those in their entirety on video to VHS, and then just going home and watching them with my wife. And then it got to where they would like show it over and over and over, like the same 3 hours. And yeah, maybe there's too much of it now, but I've spoken to a bunch of people who just sit and watch it for hours, like every day,
right.
and just savor the scenery and the experience, and you know, more power to them if they have the time to do that.
Yeah, my wife and I years ago would do that a little bit, and now I look back on that, you know, before kids and everything else, like, how did we have that time?
How did you have the time? It would be like watching sort of MLB, sort of wall to wall, you know, 6 hours of baseball a day or something. No, no one has the time for that.
A lot of the drama in races back then was because of either a lack of communication or possibly even a false communication with riders. You know, they talk about not giving time gaps and that kind of thing. What's any feelings on race radio and sort of the race being controlled from cars at this point?
Oh yeah, I've heard that. Now you have to know I'm much more knowledgeable about that earlier era when stuff was shouted out of cars and written on blackboards and things like that. And where you could have a situation where Greg wasn't aware that Hino had cracked and had fallen back and didn't know how far back he was and had to ask other team cars and stuff to find out where he was. I think it's a little bit kind of robotic now. And maybe a little less exciting, and maybe someday the sport will come up with ways to maybe reinvest the tour with a little more spontaneity that maybe it lacks now. But I'm not as familiar with the race as it's raced now. And I guess there was an edition of the tour when I kind of called it quits again.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the year when you had a Dane named Rasmussen, who was in the lead. He was holding the Maillot Jaune one day. And then the next he was gone. He had vanished. He had disapparated. And nobody in the team coverage of the race on the television even mentioned his name. I mean, think of that. If it were like national American Fox broadcast coverage of a major Big Five sport, they'd be all over that.
Right.
I mean, it was, you know, when we come back from commercial, let's talk with these two new experts about what happened to that guy. No, it was as if there was some sort of collusion. It was just, it was 1984-ish. It was as if he'd never existed. And after that, from that point on, I watched less and less of the tour because it really broke me as a fan, you know?
Le Mans, and especially, and you talk about a lot of, you know, his relationship with his father and how his father even set aside or sold his real estate business once he sort of got into the Greg Le Mans.
Yeah, he
industries.
Managed him kind of full time.
Yeah, and that was a change as well. And of course, it, you know, rubbed the French the wrong way that they're asking for a big contract. But that kind of changed, or was the beginning of cyclists being able to, I think, make more of a living. But
yeah.
I want to chat about that, but also what I see from that, where it's still not the same, and you talk about A-Rod and guys in Major League Baseball, in that they have a union, and a lot of what they do as far as money, as far as, you know, you can't blood test these guys because it's an constitutional invasion of privacy, and they're able to somehow make that argument. That doesn't happen for cyclists. I mean, it's such a different world, and it's almost a, and especially during this era, it's, you know, it's a blue collar pursuit that that either you're in it and you get hurt and your career is kind of over. And that's, Greg sort of, I think, changed that a little bit, at least with the contract negotiations.
Oh yeah. Changed it a lot. There is an issue of, I think it's Velo with Greg's face on the cover surrounded by like $20 bills. And, you know, it's, I don't remember what the headline is, like the Money Machine or something. And yeah, people really looked askance at that at the time. But what was happening was that Greg and his father, Bob, were coming to the bargaining table with an American attitude about sports, which is that you might only have a window of 5 or 6 or 7 years before you get injured or before you age out of your peak. And in American baseball or football, the way you negotiate is with that in mind, that you've got to kind of make your entire life's wages during this 5-6 years. And Bob LeMond came into negotiations with that attitude. Greg's got to make his money now. We don't know how long this will last. And evidently, the cyclists in the peloton, all the way up to and including Eno in that era, were, I would say, underpaid, certainly by comparison to the great American athletes. And probably it was thought that, well, they were lucky to be paid at all, you know, and 12,000 francs a year or whatever it is was enough. And so you ended up with this ridiculous situation for a short time where Greg was, I think, earning more even than Eno, and more than any of the Pascal Simon, Fignon, all those guys, and probably Phil Anderson and Stephen Roach. And then fairly quickly, the economics of the sport adjusted. And then after that, from then on, it was like, well, thank you, Greg. You know, you and your father really kind of set things right, so that from then on, cyclists could earn kind of a lifetime of earnings during the years of their peak if they were very lucky.
The hunting accident and recovering from that, and then, you know, the comeback and being able to win the tour, in your opinion, take that away, what does Greg LeMond's career look like? I mean, you already talked about, you know, obviously we're going to run up against the 90s when the EPO shows up.
Yes, but that's a hard stop to his career, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I ask this question in a lot of book talks, and we all exchange puzzled glances and try to figure out how many tours might he have won. Now, the big Greg LeMond, you know, zealots out there, oh, 6, you know, 7, 10. But realistically, his career is bookended with two unfortunate truths. One is, at the beginning, you have the politics of cycling, which dictate that he is the lieutenant to Fignon in 84.
And despite being the strongest guy out there.
Did I say Fignon? Yeah.
Yeah, not Fignon.
Despite possibly being the strongest guy out there.
Yeah.
And so he helps Fignon win in 84. And then in 85, he's the lieutenant to Hino and helps Hino win.
Right? Okay, right.
Yeah. Yep. It's complicating. But so both those years, and this is nothing it's not like Greg is unduly suffering here. This is how it works. You're on this sort of team, and you're hired to help another person win. So he could have won maybe in either of those years, but that's not anything to do with any sort of unfairness. I mean, it's just part of cycling.
Sure.
So considering that, if you get no hunting accident, you have Greg winning in 86. He certainly could have beaten Roach and Delgado in 87 and 88. For those unfamiliar with those two characters, Stephen Roach from Ireland, Pedro Delgado from Spain. Greg was the better cyclist. He could have beaten either. So maybe two more victories, 89, 90, that's 5. But that then puts Greg in the unique position of having won 5 consecutive tours, which before EPO, nobody did. So you have to assume that it was at least possible that something else might have struck him down in one of those years. Accident, injury, illness, who knows, tapeworm. I mean, anything could have happened. So when I have this conversation at book talks, we usually end up thinking that, well, without the hunting accident, he probably would have won at least one more tour. Maybe he didn't end up a 4-time winner. And yeah, there's injustice aplenty in his career that he had to subjugate himself to Hino in 85 and Fignon in 84, and that everyone else was on EPO to some extent in the 90s, but those are what they are.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah, it's interesting. And plus, you know, I guess to Armstrong's credit, he stayed on his bike for those 7 wins. You know, we can at least give him that, yeah. Right? You know,
he rode the races from start to finish.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's a huge accomplishment right there for anybody, but to do it and do it, you know, where you're never, you know, we saw talk about the Musette, you know, incident or that kind of stuff where they waited for them. I mean, you know, that can happen at any time. They're riders. We see it all the time. We see it now with a lot more cobbles being introduced, and it's just, you know, ending people's races before they even begin. So that there definitely is some luck that's involved in it too.
I think if you take the super dope away from everyone and the super preparation that went on in that era, that you probably wouldn't have had someone, let's even say that Armstrong was indeed the most physically gifted, he still isn't going to win that many consecutive tours because Merckx couldn't do it.
Right.
You know, the great French Anquetil couldn't do it. Mm. If those guys couldn't do it, I'm sorry, Lance Armstrong wouldn't have been able to do it without AIDS. My gut tells me that somebody as naturally talented as Ulrich, I want to say if things really had been equal, I think Ulrich could have beaten Armstrong. That was what my gut told me at the time. That was what Phil and Paul were kind of saying, the amazingly gifted steam engine.
Well, that's what Armstrong would say all the time. That was part of the mind games, you know?
and my gut tells me, I mean, what the heck do I know? But I feel like there were, and maybe a few other people out there in those years, who knows? Like, Basso was a great writer, but he was implicated in stuff too. So I want to say that those incredibly gifted men might have been up to beating Lance at least some of the time, maybe not all the time.
What is something that we don't see as much anymore that I always thought was great about this generation of cyclists as well, because I kind of can definitely see where they're coming from, is everybody got out of shape. You know, you talk about Le Mans putting on what, like 20 pounds
And he did that too.
Yeah.
And
but that seemed to be like this is how you do it. You have to give your body a break.
Take a break. Yeah. Drink some beer.
That's no longer the case.
No.
Now it's just all year long. Like, you know, there's periodization where you go super in shape, but you never really fall out of shape. And it's sort of sad that there's no longer like this off season for these guys to kick back.
The Belgian brothers, Dijonker, I'm saying their names wrong, Noël Dijonker, told Greg, you must drink as much as you can and eat as much as you can now, because once you go to France and join Renault, that'll be it. You'll never have free time again. So he put on some pounds even before he went to France in the first place.
But that was, and it's great. You know, again, I want to go get this book. Go read it. I mean, as I'm sitting here and fanning out about this stuff, obviously I know all these stories, as you said, but it was still entertaining from beginning to end, and learn a ton more. So if you're a cycling fan, you think you know all of what's happened in Le Mans' career, it's worth the read. I think that you can, convincing a non-cycling fan to pick up a cycling book, I think that's probably part of your challenge. But I think this does it, because you really go into the history. You know, you talk about track racing in the U.S. and Major Taylor, and then how, you know, people don't understand, you know, things like the Madison race, named after Madison Square Garden, you know, all of that, how huge it was in the U.S. and then just vanished.
What I would say to the person who's listening to this who thinks they've heard everything there is to be heard about Greg is that I promise you haven't. Like, people like Leonard Zinn, who reviewed my book for the Journal, he found a lot of stuff in there that he'd never heard before. And if he's going to find many, many revelations, then you will too. And to the person who's not a huge fan, you know, I refer you to like The Boys in the Boat or Seabiscuit. Would you recommend those books because, rowing is great? No, it's not a book about rowing. It's an amazing story that happens to be in that setting of rowing. And same thing with Seabiscuit and horse racing. You don't read it because you like horse racing. You read it because it's an amazing story. And with Greg's story, I wouldn't put it in the same category as those two books. But what I was trying to do was to just bring forth this amazing story that happens to be about bicycle racing. But it's the story that's the thing. And so your friend who likes good reads but doesn't care about cycling, I think they'd love it, you know.
what in here, not to spoil anything for anybody that's going to read this, but what in here, what surprised you the most that you found out?
What surprised me the most? I would have to say it was just the enormity of and the enormous number and sort of gravitas of challenges that this character faced. I knew what had happened in 89 and that Greg had gotten shot and come back. And I sort of vaguely knew that he was kind of like a real life breaking away, that he'd conquered this alien sport in the same sense of like, what if a Belgian came over and like became a star pitcher on the Yankees? Mm. It was that improbable. But I didn't know about all the other stuff. I did not know about this whole era of the 90s where he kept trying to figure out why he wasn't winning anymore.
And, yeah, and that was, yeah,
all this stuff was happening. Sure. I didn't know about that. I had no idea the full scale of the war that went on between LeMond and Armstrong. I knew that they'd had some words, and I knew that there'd been some conflict, but I had no idea the scale of it and the absolute devastation that it sort of unleashed on Greg's life. So yeah, I mean, I guess I was stunned at how much this dude had been through.
Yeah.
And still am, you know. And I guess as a writer, I'm grateful for all that. But as a human being, I've at some point, if next time I see him, I say, dude, how did you survive all this stuff? How did you get through it all? You know, because I never really asked him that specific question.
Sure. Is there an Audible version of this?
Yeah. I've got it on my desk at home. You can listen to this book as you ride. You can read it. It's in all different formats.
Yeah.
And I would encourage anybody who's interested, you know, you could get it on Amazon. You could also get it from an independent bookstore. If you go to my website, danieldevizet.com, you can find it there. I have links to the indie book universe, which I love and adore. I've had like 20 or 30 book talks at different places. And definitely. It's a good training partner.
Yeah. Anything else you want to chat about here as we sort of end up our hour?
No, just to say that I just think that bicycle racing is a beautiful sport. I feel terrible about what's happened to it these last, 30 years. And I thought that all you people needed a really happy, uplifting, celebratory story. And this I hope is it.
Yeah, so it certainly
that's
is.
That's why I did it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it sending over. As I said, I really enjoyed it. And social media, anywhere people can follow you?
I'm on Twitter, Daniel DeVizet. I'm on Facebook. It's funny, my friends on Facebook, it's hundreds of basically fellow journalists, because I was at the Washington Post, mm-hmm. at the Miami Herald for years and years and years. On Twitter, it's now I have a good gang that I follow of great cycling reporters, cycling journalists, and then also a bunch of people from my former, you know, lives. I've probably been a little more active on Twitter now than I was with my last book, because there's not a huge Andy Griffith Show group out there on Twitter, but there's a lot of cycling people, and I've been delighted to interact with them.
Outstanding. They can ask you questions about all the bike shares.
Yeah, you've been anytime.
On. Yeah. Yeah. And you were talking about you rode bike share over here. Oh, so that's the next pursuit, huh?
Bike share. I'm an expert on bike share at this point. I've done so many bike shares all over the West Coast. And we've got a pretty good one in DC.
What do you think about the motor doping in bike share?
isn't there talk about allowing motorized bicycles as a thing in like cyclocross?
Not in cyclocross, but
mountain biking?
There is the UCI just in their latest dispatch from their executive committee meeting had in there the formation of an e-bike category for races.
Yeah, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of kids would get drawn into the sport if they knew they could do that. I mean,
yeah.
it's super fun.
We already see it, you know, that we see it from kids who excel in cyclocross and mountain biking and like downhill that come from a motocross background.
Okay,
you know? Because you're doing these things and you have this skill at such a fast pace, and then when you get on just an ordinary bicycle, I've talked to a lot of guys like this. It's like they're racing in slow motion.
Which is a good thing, right?
Which is awesome. Yeah. So they're able to see those turns and make those turns instinctively and just have all this time to set up the corners and everything else.
It's like taking Mario Kart and slowing it down.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So, yeah. I don't got on too much of a tangent here about that world, but I would say the motors in cyclocross, definitely a bad thing.
there has to be a place for e-bikes in the future, a legitimate, authorized, acknowledged place, but not as a thing that a few people are sneaking into the race.
Yeah, I think that people take their love of racing and they move it over to e-bikes in everyday life and want to be against it to the point that, you know, I fall into this too. You get on your daily commute on your bike and then it becomes a competition. You know, all of a sudden this guy's passing and you and was like, well, he's obviously, you know, on an e-bike, he couldn't be climbing up there.
He's dopey. So,
yeah, exactly. Where it's the other side of it is I'd love to see more people. If people want to leave their cars at home and everybody's on
an
e-bike,
that'll get
that'd
people
be
on
amazing.
A bike is a good thing, I think.
Yeah.
My kids and I rode e-bikes in Sacramento and my kids, it was a revelation for them. They loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. I did it at Inner Bike 1 year. I was on this fat tire e-bike. And then the downside is we were climbing up this huge hill to go to the trails, and then my battery died.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and then got like a 60-pound bike. That's
oh
not
my
fun.
God. Did you get it up the hill?
Yeah, it was not the workout I wanted, though. That's awesome. Well, Dan, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me. It was really my pleasure.
And there you have it, Daniel Duvisay. Great conversation. Glad he stopped by. It was fun talking to him. Go get the comeback. You won't be disappointed. You can find out more information at Dan's website. That's danieldevise.com, Danieldevise.com. You can also use that name to follow him on Twitter at Daniel Duvisay. Also, check out the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network. Become a member of wideanglepodium.com. Got any questions? Send them to feedback@cxhairs.com. Follow me on Instagram and Twitter at cxhairs. And also go to YouTube and follow the CX Hairs page. I think if you just search for CX Hairs, you'll be able to find it. You can also get there going to crosshairstelevision.com. All right, we'll talk to you soon. Full slate of cyclocross news and reporting coming into your ears next week.